A couple of weeks ago, in synagogues around the world, we read these words that have resonated down through the centuries. In fact, they've resonated down through 35 of them. Well, that's interesting. We've also been here for 35, not centuries, but years. Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. Ve-ha-aretz hayata tohu ve-vohu. Ve-hoshek al-penei techom. Vayomer Elohim yehi or vayehi or. And so, these words have resonated down through the ages. And in fact, even in the 91st, in her 91st year of my mom's life, these words still echoed in her mind. I can recall her quoting them to me many times down through the years. She and Eve shared this very reading a dozen years ago, the day before Eve and John got married. Then just weeks before her death, I mentioned to Mom on the phone that Eve had read this very text in the synagogue in honor of the 10th anniversary of their reading it together. When I quoted these verses to her, according to the caregiver by her side, Mom smiled. Yes, it's a very moving, stirring, and awesome text. Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. A wonderful indicator of life and blessing. But then it says, ha-aretz tohu v'vohu. And then it talks about ve-hoshek. Chaos and emptiness and darkness. In fact, as one translation has it, it was astonishingly empty and dark. And then, as the text goes on to say, out of that chaos and that emptiness, God brings life and light and order and fullness. I apologize, but only half-heartedly. This parsha reminds me of the delicious science that provides context to our text. So even if this means nothing to you, come along for the ride, because I enjoy it. As we look at the situation that is here behind the text, there's an absolute nothingness, blacker than black holes, before time itself. Oh, by the way, some of this information's in the handout in the bulletin. And then suddenly, the Big Bang, an explosive expansion as 11 plus dimensions collapse into 4 in the minutest fraction of a microsecond. And we should be saying, wow. Even the great skeptic Voltaire said it's impossible for this clock to exist without a clockmaker. The universe, we're told, is something between 13 and 14 billion years old. And as you see it in the handout, that roughly equates to 10 to the 10th power. Now, we also know that the universe, at the absolute maximum, has a billion trillion potential planets. In case you're counting, as you see it in the notes, that's 10 to the 21st power. Therefore, the maximum probability for life in the universe is 10 to the 31st power if a new opportunity for life presented itself every year on every planet. That's a lot of opportunities. And it's 10 to the 38th if a new opportunity for life presented itself every second on every planet. But here's the catch. There are some 40-plus factors, each absolutely essential for complex life, each of which, in turn, must be precisely fine-tuned within a very limited range. And all 40-plus factors must be present for complex life forms to exist. That's us. Now, we may be somewhat simple, and we probably are, but trust me, we're very complex. In this particular rendition of it. Now, the odds for that happening, the 40-plus happening by chance, are 1 out of 10 to the 134th power. That's 10 with 134 zeros tagged on after it. In other words, we miss the probabilities by nearly 100 orders of magnitude. Let me give you an example. We could far more easily find one specific, not atom, but subatomic particle, which we had marked beforehand, among the 10 to the 80th power number of subatomic particles that exist in the universe. Are you still with me? Paint one red and see if you can find it. among the 10 with 80 zeros tagged on after it. In fact, if there was a new opportunity for life that popped up every second of those 14 billion years on every particle, not planet, on every particle, we'd still be some 37 orders of magnitude short, because that only comes to 10 with 97 zeros after it. You see, God's design of Earth and our universe is extremely delicate and very sophisticated. For example, and I'm only going to give you a couple examples here, if our atmosphere lacked carbon or hydrogen or oxygen or nitrogen, or even if we had all these elements in different proportions, life would be impossible. So if Earth's typical temperature was a few degrees higher, life would have been destroyed. If Earth's typical temperature was a few degrees colder, life would be impossible to sustain. The Earth's orbit, if it was slightly tighter, would have seen Earth burned up long ago. But if it were slightly looser, Earth would have drifted further from the sun, and we would have frozen, and I'm not talking about the movie. These facts and these odds and probabilities argue for a creator, as Voltaire, the skeptic, conceded, because there is an extremely intricate order to allow for life. Unfortunately, this wonderfully intricate order and precise fine-tuning got knocked out of whack. And so we read of Noah's time, and we read it last week, Vayara Elohim et ha'aretz vehine. And wow, if you want to translate it, Nishchata. God looked at the earth, and it was corrupted. It was out of whack. In contrast to what we read in the text from 2 weeks ago, God said, he called it Tov. Good. So what did God do? He washed it away. And so now in this text from last week, we have a new beginning. A new beginning with Noah and the Noahide covenant that God made with all people. However, along comes tonight's portion, Lech Lecha, and the story of Abraham and Sarah. So? Well, it too is a new beginning. Number three, a new beginning. Well, think about it with me. Genesis, there are 50 chapters in Genesis. Don't count them. Trust me, there are 50 chapters in Genesis. In the first 11, we speed through such things as the creation of the universe, the creation of the earth, the creation of humankind, the Tower of Babel, the Great Flood, the story of Noah. 11 chapters cover thousands, if not millions, of years. And then you get to chapter 12. Chapters 12 to 50 cover about 150 years. It's as if God had put the brakes on. Stop. He says, I want you to look at something important. It indicates that God is starting something very special here that he wants us to be alert to, that he wants us to focus on. And in fact, it's the story of Sarah and Abraham and their descendants. And it's the beginning of the Jewish people. So appropriately, Genesis is a book of beginnings. And rightly do we call it in Hebrew, Bereshit, beginning. And these beginnings echo and resound through the book. But something else occurs in Jewish history and Jewish literature. They also echo throughout later Jewish literature. As you heard it read, Mark 1:1 begins, here begins the wonderful story. That's one of the translations in the pew. Or simply, the beginning of the good news in the other translation. That sure sounds an awful lot like Genesis 1:1 to me, which could also be rephrased, here begins the amazing story. So yes, we have still another beginning. Mark starts out by saying, if you were to translate it into Hebrew, Bereshit Besora Yeshua HaMashiach Ben Elohim, very much like our text from a couple weeks ago. Bereshit. And then you also have Elohim in that text, as you do here. In other words, you have a beginning in Mark, and God's around at the beginning. So Mark's intent, then, is to use that Genesis setting as a backdrop for his account. And so suddenly we find ourselves at yet another beginning. Now, the main thrust of this gospel finds its center and substance right here at the beginning with Yeshua, described as God the Son. And it sort of raises this question, so who and what is this central character who comes to inaugurate, as he says, the reign of God on earth? He literally appears out of the blue, unannounced by any nativity or infancy story, and is witnessed to by only the lonely voice of the one whom history has called John the Baptist. And he wasn't, because Baptists weren't around at that time. Nor were Methodists. Nor were Presbyterians. Nor were Lutherans. And if I've left you out, I'm truly sorry. He was John the Jew. And then the historical record is narrated with such swift flowing succession of events that we are hurried along to a climax with a rapid fire, and immediately. Moreover, the appearances of Yeshua are so tantalizingly brief and so crisply narrated and so half veiled in mystery and movement that the revelation of Yeshua's person is both half displayed and half concealed. And so it raises that age-old question. Some of you are too young to have heard this question. Who was that masked man? Thank you for those of you who were around to understand that. Mark, it is clear, is modeling his work on the Torah. He intends the reader to catch the profound thought that his book takes us back into the very mists of time, or before the very mists of time, and then proceeds dramatically with a declaration of good news now told with the coming of Yeshua. It was hinted at. Remember Jesse's son, the Bethlehemite? Why is he the Bethlehemite? Because Micah 5:2 tells us that that's where he would be born. But we don't go to the end of that verse, which says Old English, goings forth have been from days of eternity. In other words, he's been around a long time. And what Mark is saying is, as God was active and present then, so now. It's the onset of the Messianic age. And as God bursts on the scene in Genesis 1, so also Yeshua bursts on the scene in Mark chapter 1. And divine intervention occurs again in a number of places within this book. We'll start near the beginning. At the beginning of the story, it was read to you. Mark 1, verse 11, the text says, the heavens were torn open, and a voice came out of heaven. A voice came out of heaven? Vayomer Adonai, Yehi Or Vayehi Or. And God spoke. It reflects on that. God's arrival on the scene here in Mark is preceded by a brief but long-promised ancient announcement that helps us understand what's going on. The text you heard read, it is written in Isaiah the prophet, I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way. That's not in Isaiah, that's Malachi. But don't worry about that, that's part of Roots 2. You can take that in the spring. I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way. A voice of one calling in the desert. Prepare the way. That's the Isaiah text. Prepare the way for whom? For the Lord. Make straight paths for him. And that's what John the Jew was doing. But friends, this Malachi 3 text that is quoted here has much more to it. Stuff Mark and his Jewish readers would have understood readily. So we ought to understand it as well if we want to understand Mark's account. In fact, we need to understand some very basic stuff like never slap a person who's chewing tobacco. Never kick a cow chip on a hot day. Oh, and by the way, never miss a good chance to shut up. Sorry. Back to our task. What was it that Mark and his Jewish readers understood regarding the Malachi passage? Well, let's read it, and it's full. The text says, see, I will send my messenger who will prepare the way before me. Then it goes on to say, then suddenly, just like in Mark, the Lord you are seeking will come to his temple. So says the Lord Almighty. In the 12th century, one of our most famous rabbis and commentators, David Kimchi, simply put it this way concerning the Malachi text: the Lord is King Messiah. He made the connection that Mark wanted us to understand and as his readers understood. That's what sets up Mark's account, his wonderful story, namely God personally intervening in history. Yeshua then explodes onto the scene in a more populated part of Israel. Mark chapter 1, verse 21 says the following: they went to Capernaum. We were just there. Some of you were there a few years earlier. And when Shabbat came, Yeshua went into the synagogue and began to teach. And then it all starts as you read those passages. Yeshua heals Peter's mother-in-law. Yeshua cleanses a leper. Yeshua heals a paralytic man. Yeshua restores a withered hand. Yeshua quiets the storm. Yeshua restores a deaf-mute person. In fact, if you count, you will find in the first seven chapters of Mark, there are 16 miracles. And he exercises, and that's significant, but not for right now. And he exercises his power over every realm, whether that's illness or disease, even nature itself. And so, as Job points out, as only God can do, Yeshua walks on the waves. And the text goes on to say, and he makes as if to pass the disciples by, just as God passed Moses by on Mount Sinai. In other words, Mark is letting his readers know, and as his readers today, we should be listening with Jewish ears and eyes, that this character is truly a supernatural character. Now, years, even centuries before Mark, before all this, Isaiah himself had said something striking, had pleaded, "Oh, that you would rend or tear apart the heavens like a curtain and come down." Well, Mark does have an image of the heavens themselves tearing open in the passage that was read to you. He uses the term tear open rather than the usual term simply for open. This image of the tearing open of the heavens probably arose from Mark's picturing the heavens like a piece of cloth, and then imagining the heavens opening as mentioned in Isaiah. But this word, as is suggested, to tear open, rather than the more common simply open, does appear one more time in Mark. And this is the key. It appears at the final moment we see Yeshua. At the very instant of Yeshua's death, as he breathes his last, Mark tells us that the veil of the temple was torn open in two from top to bottom. Let me suggest it's striking, therefore, to discover that precisely at the first moment that Yeshua appears in Mark's gospel, and precisely at the last moment that we see him, something is torn open. That this is not simply coincidence is suggested by a number of other themes that are also repeated at precisely these two junctures, but we don't have time for that either. We'll talk about that in Roots 2. Yes, that was another blatant commercial for the seminary courses. Further, the reality is that the two things that are torn in Mark's gospel, beginning and end, the heavens and the temple curtain, were symbolically connected in ancient Jewish thought. As it turns out, the first century Jewish historian Josephus describes the appearance of the curtain of the temple in great detail. According to Josephus, it was a gigantic curtain some 80 feet high. Josephus then tells us what was pictured on this great curtain, and he says, on this tapestry was portrayed a panorama of the heavens, end quote. In other words, the outer curtain of the Jerusalem temple was actually one huge image of the starry sky. So any of Mark's very Jewish readers who had ever seen the temple or heard it described, on reading Mark's statement that the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, they would have instantly have pictured an image of the heavens being torn, and would then immediately have been reminded of Mark's description of the heavens tearing at the very beginning of his story at Yeshua's Tevilah, his immersion. The tearing of the heavens, which occurs at both the precise beginning and at the precise end of Yeshua's earthly career, therefore served as an emphatic, symbolic form of inclusion. There's a technical term for it. You won't understand it at all. It's inclusio. It's a bracketing. It brackets the entire gospel. In other words, the story of the good news. You see, for Mark, the significance of the tearing of the heavenly curtain cannot be reduced to a simple allegorical connection or a literary metaphor. I'm going to suggest to rather it was Mark's way of symbolizing his sense that the coming of Yeshua represented the invasion of a cosmic world-shattering force that produced a deep rupture in the very fabric of reality itself. This rupture in the fabric of reality literally tears its way through Mark's gospel from the precise beginning to the precise end. It opens up a narrative space of enormous dimensions that gives immense power to the story that unfolds on that grand stage that Mark paints for us. And it spotlights the central character, the supernatural Son, revealed as if the curtains on that stage are being opened. It's an answer to the promises and prayers of our people down through the ages. We didn't do it as part of the Amidah tonight. It's paragraph one. We look forward to the time when God will send a Redeemer to His people for the sake of His name. Mark saying, yes, the hope has in fact been granted. New? That's Yiddish for so, in case you're not familiar with Yiddish. Most of you are by now. Mark chapter 1 again, verse 14. Yeshua went into Galilee, proclaiming the good news, that grand story of God. He said, the time has come. The time has come. The kingdom of God is near. Repent and believe the good news. In other words, experience the transformation of life that those who experienced Yeshua's touch experienced in their lives. Experience the transformation of life that those who experienced Yeshua's touch experienced in their own lives. And then, he says, two verses later, now come and follow me. I like this translation. You'll understand in a minute why. He says, I will make you fishers of men. It's a great image for back then. I'm not so sure it's as good for now. What he's saying is, you will take the message and bring others into following me if you come and follow me. And our message to them, these people we are fishing for, so to speak, and for that matter, our hope for ourselves, well, part of it is this. Life isn't only about how to survive the storm, but also learning how to dance in the rain, as one person put it. Now, for those of you who know me, you know I can't tell this story without telling another story. It's a reminder and an encouragement from another almost Jewish field of literature. I say almost Jewish because the author was married to a Jew. That's close enough. And for those of you who know me, you know what the story is. It comes from the magician's nephew and C.S. Lewis. And it reminds us of what our response needs to be. Then two wonders, Lewis says, happened at the very same moment. One was that the lion's grand voice was suddenly joined by other voices. The lion, of course, is a picture of the Messiah. The lion's grand voice was suddenly joined by other voices, more voices than you could possibly count. They were in harmony with the lion's deep, warm voice, but they were far higher up the scale. Cold, tingling, silvery voices. The second wonder was that the blackness overhead all at once was suddenly blazing with stars. They didn't come out gently one by one. One moment there'd been nothing but complete darkness. The next moment, 1,000,000 points of light instantly leaped out, single stars, constellations, and planets bigger and brighter than any in our world. That sort of sounds like our opening text from Bereshit. Back. The new stars and the new voices began at exactly the same time. If you had seen and heard it, you would have felt quite certain that it was the stars themselves which were singing. and that it was the first voice, the deep one, which had made them all appear and made them all sing a wonderfully brand new song. "Glory be," said the cabbie. "I'd have been a better man all my life if I had known there were things like this." How about you? You know there are things like this. We just reminded ourselves. Creation and our Creator should motivate us to be better creatures. One final thought as a P.S., epilogue, whatever you want to call it. This too comes from a Jewish source. His name is Yoda. What? Yoda is the Hebrew word for knowledge. So I can steal it. He raised the question which I now raise. Can one ray of light save the universe? The answer is, depends on who's holding it and how many are. You holding the light? Your turn to respond. Take the next minute or so in quiet to do so.